offered a stage to you both.
How's the sound? Is it loud enough?
Perfect.
You can ask. Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
All right, we're going to start off.
Okay, hold on.
Away after the bold and brilliantly executed burglary of a Montreal branch of the Bank of Nova Scotia, in which more than $5 million in today's dollars had been stolen. His neighbors at the Marina knew him as René Roy, an easygoing and affable French-Canadian who came from money and was an expert yachtsman and skin diver. What he didn't know on that perfect Florida day was that a satellite, Instalot 1, nicknamed Early Bird, had just been launched at Cape Canaveral, less than 200 miles away, and it was going to derail the life of the Playboy yachtsman. As Early Bird, the world's first commercial communication satellite, broke through the Earth's atmosphere and settled into its orbit 22,300 miles above the equator just off the coast of Brazil, some of the Western world's major law enforcement agencies, the FBI, Scotland Yard, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were planning an event that would forever change the way policing was handled. Less than a month after Early Bird was launched, LeMay's mugshot was splashed across North America into millions of households during the satellite's first intercontinental television broadcast on May 2nd. 5 days later, federal agents and local police arrested LeMay on his yacht. The FBI had been tipped off by a local boat repairman who had recognized LeMay while watching the Early Bird television special. For the first time in history, a criminal was apprehended using an international communication satellite. When LeMay asked how they found him, he marveled at the answer. "It took a satellite to catch me," he mused with obvious pride. He later jokingly referred to himself as Satellite Boy. And that's only half the story. Whew.
I could have given you a shorter synopsis.
It's okay. And now just a few words about who Andrew is. Andrew Emmelings is a freelance journalist who has previously written 3 historical true crime books. He held down a variety of jobs, from bartending in New Orleans to burlesque dancing in New York City.
Ooh.
I want to hear about that.
I want to see that.
Before spending a decade as an award-winning investigative crime reporter for several news organizations, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Berkshire Eagle. His work has appeared in Business Insider, Smithsonian, Men's Journal, Modern Farmer, and elsewhere. He lives in New York's Hudson Valley, a.k.a.
Catskill.
All right, welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
again, since the book just came out, even though I just read that long synopsis, can you just briefly tell us what the book is about? Two cents. Because that synopsis didn't really mention.
Right. So basically, there's two overlapping stories. One about the sort of other space race that has sort of, you know, compared to manned space exploration, just gotten sort of short shrift, and nobody really knows about it. And it's arguably way more important to our daily lives than, you know, somebody walking on the moon. And so I wanted to sort of unearth this missing piece of history, but I wanted to do it in a way that I could hold the reader's attention, which magically, thanks to LeMay, happened through this intersection of a master thief and a guy named Harold Rosen, an engineer who worked for Hughes Aircraft, Howard Hughes' company, and was the guy who made this happen. I guess that was way more than 2 cents.
That's okay. And so the technology at the heart of this story is the geostationary satellite, which we all take for granted today, right? But satellites are, they provide, tell us about what the satellite does.
Harold Rosen, around 57 is when he sort of first came across this idea of creating a satellite that would be in high enough orbit that it would provide coverage. Like one satellite could do one third of the world, so you only need three satellites to cover the entire planet. And at the time, you know, mass communication did not really exist in the same ways that we understand it. There was, if you wanted to make an international telephone call, you had to sign a list and wait, and it could take literally weeks before you would be able to make a call, and it was, you know, exorbitant prices. And so with this satellite, they were able to, like, tenfold the amount of phone lines from Europe to North America. And before this, there was no such thing as, you know, live television from, you know, you couldn't watch any news, breaking news happening across the world. They'd have to fly the tape over to the U.S. or vice versa. So there was like a very long gap in how long it would take for news to get from one place to the other. Harold Rosen comes up with this idea, but separately, Arthur C. Clarke had first written about this in 1945, way before he wrote 2001: A Space Odyssey. And so this idea was actually science fiction before it was reality. And at the time when Harold Rosen sort of posited this idea to his bosses, they were like, "You're insane. No, you can't do this. We don't have the rocket power to get it that high. You know, there's nothing. We can't create one that's even a small enough size to get you know, even if we could get a rocket that would launch it that far, that'd have to be a tiny little thing. And so he very slowly knocked out every single aspect of what was needed to create this satellite, and he basically changed the world.
And the story is set in the 60s, right? Most of it. How does that affect what's going on at the time in the world, in the country?
Wanted the era to be its own character almost. I definitely tried to provide a lot of scene setting to scene setting. Tried to provide a lot of scene setting to really place these two characters in their time and place. And they also sort of are archetypal for their era. One was, because the 60s, was the space age. That was when all these things occurred. And also, you sort of have Georges LeMay, who was really thumbed his nose at authority. He loved being in the newspapers. So he would call up Montreal Press, hiding out, and be like, let me tell you what I'm doing. That sort of represented that other aspect of the 60s, where it was sort of the jettisoning of a more staid kind of, gray flannel suit era.
And then the crime that he was eventually caught for. What? Which is also, it's like this amazing sequence at the beginning of the book that takes the first several chapters, basically, is the description of the bank robbery that is the thing that everyone is looking for Georges LeMay for. Once they figure out that it was him that did it, he that did it. Can you describe the bank robbery?
Sure. I need to start with the fact that he was not some down and out guy who did this because he needed to survive. He came from a fairly wealthy family with a long history in Montreal, and he was already a sort of playboy character before he ever took up crime. For him, it was all about the planning. He loved the planning. He loved, all the sort of minutiae that would be required to pull this off. And in this case, he chose a bank that he knew was used by the criminal underworld. So there was a lot of loot stashed there that the government didn't even know about. And also, the Diamond District was very near, and so there was a lot of the diamond dealers who kept things there as well. Anyway, he figures out that there's this unused or disused sewer line that goes right underneath the bank. So he and his crew they ended up having to spend a couple of weekends to get it accomplished. They drilled and blasted their way. And this is in downtown Montreal. This is not somewhere. This is in the heart of Montreal when he's doing this. They only worked at night. They only worked on weekends. And eventually they pulled out. And I realized the synopsis you read, it was from one of my earlier iterations. And what he actually pulled off was the equivalent of about $20 million today. So it was a huge, huge heist. And it was brilliantly executed, and the cops had no idea who pulled it off for almost a year until one of his compatriots went back to being a forger and got caught and squealed on all those beats.
There's a detail in the bank robbery that you add that while they were doing the blasts underneath the ground, a couple of the people were up on the street and to check if it, you could hear them, and you couldn't hear anything. They couldn't hear anything. So these, you know, dynamites are going off underneath the ground, and nothing. No one knows the why. No one's the wiser up above. It's really crazy. And just to go back for a second, so how did you even hear about this story?
So it all started when I was working at the Berkshire Eagle. And I used to illegally park at the library because there was never any parking at the courthouse where I always spent my time. And I always felt bad, so I would always pay my 50 cents. They had like a permanent fixture of 50-cent books. You know, the money goes to the library. So every time I went through, I always bought a book from the library. And, you know, by the time I left the Eagle, I had, like, a pile of books in the trunk. Anyway, one of these books was this, it was called The Almanac of World Crime, and it was, it's not in print anymore, but it's got Nash, who would, like, he's actually still alive. I don't know if he's still writing. He's, like, in his 90s. But all he does is write, like, the Dictionary of Crime. The Almanac of Crime, the Encyclopedia of Crime. But one of these. So you know, I on before they sleep, I like to read about crime. So I was flipping through this book, and I came across this literally like two paragraph piece in the Almanac about this guy George LeMay and how he was caught using this satellite. And I was like, this is incredible. Somebody must have written this. So I did a Google search, and come to find out, nobody had, so I did. And I was like...
And then it ended up that there was, like, a personal connection, right? Because Harold Rosen is from...
From New Orleans. Yeah, he was born and raised in New Orleans. And I used to live in New Orleans.
So these two guys are... You know, there's like this, you know, debonair bank robber, and then there's this really diligent scientist, you know, separated by a whole country. But they're working at the same time, and they're both very different, but they're also kind of similar.
Their end goals were very different. One wanted to bring the world closer together. The other one just wanted to be a rich playboy without having to work. But they shared a lot of you know, the same kind of drive, the same kind of determination and way of thinking outside of the box. I hate that phrase, but. and there was, you know, as I, you know, dug into the story, I found, you know, like Harold Rosen's parents were Eastern European Jews, and they moved to Montreal in the early 1900s, and so. You know, then they moved to New Orleans, and that's where Harold was born. But so he would go back to Quebec every summer. And so, you know, there was this, I was like, how is it that this engineer from New Orleans who was working in Los Angeles also has this weird connection to Montreal? It's just, you know, there's like all these strange little things that worked nicely together and to sort of build the story up.
Yeah, I would add that they're also both super meticulous.
Yes.
Like, yeah. Because I feel like LeMay approached crime in a scientific almost way.
Yeah.
And in an imaginative way. So how did you research this book? Because it is, for those of you that get to read it, it's so detailed, so amazingly detailed, that when the crime is happening, you feel like you're there with them. And it's just amazingly detailed.
So for the Mace section, I was able to get a hold of the declassified Royal Canadian Mounted Police file that they kept on him, which was several thousand pages long, which is like full of really boring, mundane details, but there's, once you start digging, there's always little nuggets that you can use to sort of build on. Because they interviewed, this file also included a lot of whatever the FBI collected. So there was a lot of interviews after the bank robbery. And then, since he, I'll go ahead and tell you, he gets caught. I went to Montreal and to the records and got to look through all the court files, which is, it was incredible. Like, this stuff hadn't been touched in 60 years. It was just like, Govs comes out with giant folders. He's like, go for it. I was able to get in contact with this old Montreal crime reporter who knew LeMay and was able to sort of give me the really nitty-gritty stuff about the crime scene in Montreal in the early 60s, which you're not going to get anywhere else. And for Harold's story, he gave a lot of interviews before. All these guys died before I started this book. But his widow, Deborah Castleman, contacted her, and she'd been recording before he died. She would just sort of doing her these little interviews with him. She'd be like, you could tell that they were just like having breakfast, and like she would click the thing on. She'd be like, okay, send it again. And she sent them to me. And I was like, it's incredible. It's incredible stuff. It just, it's worked out really well. I could ask, bounce things off her, like, is this what he would have, responded? Like, how would he have responded to this? So it's just like literally just siphoning out the little things that, once they were stitched together, made for a cohesive, hopefully cohesive story. So, I just got really lucky, really.
And you went to Montreal, right?
I spent a lot of time. Montreal is awesome. If you haven't been, you got to go to Montreal.
Before we open it up to the audience for questions, I just wanted to hear you describe the thing that actually led to him being caught. So there was as we've described, Harold Rosen invented this geostationary satellite that was launched, and then there was a television special, right?
Yeah, it was like the first international simulcast from Europe to North America. And it was like, basically,
in 1965,
and they basically wanted to sort of present, little bits and pieces of the world to, the sort of what was going on in 1965 in the world now. And so they, there was like a mariachi band in Mexico, and Russian sailors singing on a ship moored somewhere in England, just like really seemingly random stuff. One of the obviously for me the most important thing was that they decided to do this exchanging of the most wanted, between the RCMP and FBI, Scotland Yard. And LeMay, like, they didn't even necessarily... LeMay had already been on the run for 4 years. And what, like, everybody wanted to do this other newer guy, Lucien Hervard, who was... he was a drugs, huge, huge drug smuggler. He was part of the French Connection of the film. He was the French-Canadian part of that. And he had just pulled off this crazy escape from prison in Montreal. And he, like, as similar to LeMay, he just loved to thumb his nose at authority. He, like, he wrote the warden apologizing for leaving, but he just couldn't stay, sorry. And he would, like, constantly call the press up. And so it was driving the cops insane. And so they wanted, you know, like, everybody wanted, oh, we're doing Lucien Rivard, but... George McClellan, who was the head of the RCMP, same name as the Civil War general, but he figured that since LeMay had been on the run for so long, he must have changed his name, so it was more likely that he had sort of settled into his life, and that someone would then recognize him, which is exactly what happened. But McClellan was just dragged over the coals by the Canadian government, which, you know, it's like today. It's like everybody uses whatever they can against each other. And so McClellan was like, I just caught this guy. And you guys are like mad at me about Lucien Rivard? Which eventually Rivard was caught, and he was like 20 minutes outside of Montreal at a cabin on a lake, just chilling.
Right.
Like when they caught him, he was wearing swim trunks. He was about to go swimming.
Was he also caught by the family?
No. There's interestingly, the LeMay was the one that got caught using that.
Interesting. So it's about time.
Oh, right. So we does anyone else have questions?
I do.
Yeah.
You touched on this a little while ago. I'd love to hear more about your writer's process. It sounds like you gathered a huge amount of information and did an enormous amount of research. And I'm just thinking, what did you put in? What did you leave out? How'd you make your choices? And what was your journey with, you know, first you hear the story and then the, you know, Z is the guy gets caught or whatever the end is. Yeah, could you speak a little bit about your process there?
Let's see.
You had this fantastic
writer's
group.
Yes, I did. I was part of this writer's group. Of course, I would bounce my early work off of, and they provided a lot. Really good answers to me. But generally, it was because it's a nonfiction book, and typically with a nonfiction book, you start with a proposal, which is, you know, it's an outline of how the book is going to look, so that the publisher can be like, okay, this makes sense to me. I guess you can write. Let's get the deal. And so that, you know, and obviously it changed over time, but being able to sort of chop it up into sections that I thought would work, and then sort of gathering the specific information for that chapter, and then working off of that. And then, yeah, my editors were like super helpful, and they... You know, they are the ones that suggested, let's move this chapter here to make it flow better and that kind of thing. But it was, and I forgot to mention this, the hardest part about writing this was that tons of the information was in French. My French, both my parents spoke French, and we lived in France when we were kids. My French is a little rusty. But I got through. It was basically with Google Translate and my own background in French, I was able to translate it enough to translate what I needed to translate to get it done. But yeah, it was basically trying to chop the information into useful pieces and then combine it for every chapter.
Interesting. Thank you.
I don't know, Bar.
How difficult was it to balance the two stories, or did you find it?
I guess that's really up for discussion. But I actually had a little bit more of Harold Rosen's story, but my editors actually had me condense parts so that time-wise it made more sense. The stuff of LeMay is definitely more intriguing, but for me, like, all the stuff Harold Rosen went through to get this satellite built was extremely interesting. So I think there's, at the end of it, it turned out that there was, not surprisingly, more about LeMay than Harold Rosen.
Who do you identify with between the two?
I can't answer that.
You can't answer that.
It's the man.
It's the man. Oh, wait. Of course.
He's just very debonair.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And who do you see playing them in the movie that will eventually...
Well, since we already discussed this, I'll tell you. No, I'm just throwing, like, I was really, like, before you came over yet last night, I was just, like, looking through IMDb, and I'm like,
Where'd you come over?
Javier Bardem for LeMay.
Oh. Nailed it. That's perfect.
And, Benedict Cumberbatch for Harold Rosen. You can pull off a scientist.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Here you go.
Yeah. There's a movie right there. As soon as you...
So there you go.
You need a script. It's perfect.
Any other questions?
Question about with the satellite and him being out on the yacht in Fort Lauderdale. How is it, and maybe you want the reader to discover this on their own without giving too much away, how is it that they connected him on the yacht through the satellite and the public? Was it because of the now televised information that the satellite provided? So how is it did they have a picture of him from Montreal? Was that it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And interestingly, there was like a glitch during the Montreal, the RMCP. We're supposed to do two Most Wanted, and because there was a glitch, LeMay was on the Canadian that they flashed his photograph on the television show. So, and it wasn't even like, it was actually a repeat. It wasn't even the live broadcast the boat repairman saw. So like the saw the next day. It was like, I know that guy was just working on his yacht.
Thank you.
I think it's also like really important to just point out that they knew they figured out who did the crime, who did that bank robbery, but they couldn't find him for 4 years. That was the whole thing, is that because they didn't have that technology.
Right.
He was just, you know, incognito.
Yeah, well, he was like living in plain sight.
Right.
Because in like his, you know, like this, this Montreal reporter asked him how he got away with all this, and he was like, when you have money, you can do anything.
Nothing's changed.
I mean, now you can counter that with, you can't beat Motorola. Somebody should say the ticket.
Any other questions?
Yeah, how long did the... like, did the writing process take from the time that you first, like, discovered the story in that book to, And when you finished the book?
It was a long process. I went through two different agents. It was a long process. And I actually put it aside for about a year. I found the story in 2017 and started working on it then. In between, I ended up writing another book and then finished it basically last year.
So like a good 5 years probably?
Yeah, working on and off.
You want to tell people what your next book is about?
Sure. I like to, my tagline is, it's Game of Thrones, but with 19th century New York firefighters. I'll give a little bit more. So it's about when they fought to get the first paid fire department in New York City, and all of the sort of shenanigans and things that went along with it. And in between all these, there's the massive fires that they constantly having. So it sort of tells that story. And again, it's like it's trying to create the atmosphere of post antebellum New York City.
Cool.
Okay.
And that'll come out in a couple of years.
Let's hope.
All right. I want
to say one thing before you close it off. So we'll stay open later, so stick around. Andrew will be seated here and actually will be signing the book. I want to reiterate, this book is not out yet. So this is sort of a sneaky preview. How do we say this? It's a global launch in Catskill. It's the best launch ever. Yeah. So Andrew will be here. It might be busy, but please be patient. We'll have some glasses over there as well. Everybody gets a drink, so let's have some fun.
Yay!
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it does. I'm sorry.